Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. So we're moving right along at a rapid rate. In fact, we've gotten this far. Looking good, eh?
There's more material in the box.
Yeah, thanks. We're doing a study on Thursday evenings, an ongoing study on what's called the Majjhima Nikaya. Some of you haven't been here on Thursday evening before, so I'll just do a little brief Do you want to sit up here, Pansina, or do you want to sit back there?
Oh, I have my band.
Okay. And the Majjhima Nikaya, Majjhima means middle length, or middle, medium sized. Nikaya is sayings. This is one of the 50, how many are there? 48? Sutra? How many sutra teachings are there? I can't remember, I'm sorry. This is one, there in the Buddhist tradition, there are three main categories of teaching. And they were carried around, written on banana leaves, and carried in baskets. So they're called the three baskets. There was more than three baskets, but there were three. Hi. Hello, young lady. I saw her in a lineup.
Me?
No.
Me.
Her.
Oh, that's
yes, she was in a lineup. And we said, in passing, didn't we, Ariel? Hi. You know, there's a couple of spaces up here, you guys, if you want to move up right close and poisonal. And there's text back there. We're doing the... Is there more text left?
There should be some left in the box.
There's a big... Really big
is that the last one?
Maybe sit right next to someone.
I'm going
to
share. I'm going to share one here.
Oh, there. You guys share, and...
Yeah.
Now Jack's got one, too. Okay. So, we're doing an ongoing study of the Majjhima Nikaya. This has been going on for a long time, and you can see we're plunging right ahead. we've covered a lot.
40 years?
Yeah. This is definitely ongoing. You actually were going to do this study without me for 2 months. I suddenly remember. So where are we now? What? Did you really? Do I believe you? Yeah. Okay, well, I choose not to believe you. So I'm just doing a quick review of what the Majjhima Nikaya is, because there's a few people here who don't know that. I'm presuming you don't know that. Do you know this stuff? So it's interesting background. So when the Buddha began to teach, at first he wasn't going to, and then he was presumed upon by this god, who said to him, come on, eh? Let me convince you to teach because I need the merit. And and in fact, that's pretty well what he said, not in those words, but that's. And the Buddha said, but it's too simple. No one will believe it. Now, isn't that interesting? That's what he said. A fully awakened being. He said, it's too simple. No one will believe it. Because we are thinking so much, see? We all have our ideas, don't we? Do you have an idea? How about you? You? I have an idea. I have two. Many ideas. You have to use your intellect, but not be used by it. It's too simple. No one will be able to believe it. But God said, but there might be a few beings with just a little dust in their eyes. And the Buddha said, And with his omnipotence and omnipresence and his other omnis, he looked around and he noticed that there were a few beings with just a little dust in their eyes. He said, all right, I'll give it a shot. Again, I'm paraphrasing like that. I don't think he actually said I'll give it a shot. However, you know, when I'm the Buddha, I'll probably say, I'll give it a shot. So don't hold your breath. And so he left there after a bit more meditation and doing this and that and having a good time as only Buddhas can. Then he left that spot and he started walking. And the first person he met said, oh, you look like you know something. And he said, yes, I've awakened. And they said, oh, that's nice. Excuse me, my wife is waiting for these groceries. And that was really his first teaching. And then he said, okay, I guess he learned a lot from that teaching. So then he went to the next group of people, which were the five guys that he had been practicing starvation with in order to attain a spiritual state. And then he decided that swooning from hunger and being caught in pain was not good for focus. So he had left them and they thought that he had really betrayed the cause. But he came and he taught them, and that's called the first turning of the wheel. And that was his first discourse. And then after that, one of them immediately got it, and the other four weren't too far behind. And then he started traveling, and he went somewhere else, and he gave another teaching, and then another teaching, and then some people wanted to join him. So then he had this bunch of people following him everywhere. And meanwhile, he's teaching everywhere to whoever he meets, and he speaks in a language that's appropriate to their understanding. He's a wonderful teacher. And then all these ragtag of people are following him, and then one time he comes to a town, and he's just about coming into the limits of the town, and the people from the town rush out and say, please wait here. We'll bring you food, and we'll come out here for teaching. He says, well, that's very kind of you. Why? And he said, well, last time you were here, half of our food disappeared from our gardens. Any laundry that was left on the lines was ripped off. And, you know, shoes were gone, you know, because this ragtag group of followers were running short of clothes and stuff. So the word bhikkhu, which is a most reverenced word now, actually means beggar, like homeless, a bum. That's what it means in Pali. And so that's what he called them all the people that followed him, because they just left and just followed him and tromped along after him. They were so moved by his teaching. So he said, oh, you beggars, come here. Okay, this is the rule. If you want to have new clothes, this is the kind of cloth you can pick up. You can pick up cloth from a graveyard that has been left on a corpse until the corpse has rotted. Now, in order to use this cloth, you have to boil it for so long. Then, in order to make sure that the stains of it on it from the pus and so forth won't disturb you, you have to dye it with the bark of a plane tree, and it would become a very even brown, or with saffron, and it would become a very even yellow. Then you take the pieces and you sew them together, and that's what you make the robes out of. To this day, the robes of the order are made that way. Not from that cloth, but dyed either brown or one of the colors from the plane tree dye, with the exception of the Tibetan roses. You're more of a maroon, but that's close to the brown, and made out of pieces. Right? So at various times he was called to make a pronouncement about rules, how they had to live as a community in order to not cause suffering. All of those pronouncements, complete with the story about how they came about, each rule came about, is called the Vinaya Pitaka, the basket or the collection of rules. All the teachings that were when he was wandering here or wandering there or talking to this person or talking to that person are called the Sutta Pitaka, the herd, the teaching, the collection of herd discourses. And then there is a third collection, which is called the Abhidhamma, which means the higher law teaching. So those are the three baskets. This middle-length discourses, Majjhima Nikaya, belongs to the Sutta Pitaka, the herd doctrine. It is a collection of 52 different talks that all of the people who had total recall at the time of the Buddha's death could remember him saying, that were middle-length. There is also a Digha Nikaya, which is long discourses. There's short ones. There's a Nikaya of numbers. There's all these different collections. That's what this one is. Is that good? Got an idea in time and space where this comes? Okay, so now what we're doing is we're looking at the introduction. Now we have covered, even though it's only a few pages, a fair amount, and we're on page 40. I thought it would be good to start with the introduction, because the introduction brings into focus the basic concepts of Buddhism, and it's always nice to cover those basics. This is looking at it from the Theravadin school, right? Now, do you remember any of this from the last classes I was giving? Have any of you done any work with this at all? Total silence. Do you have any questions from previous work? No questions? So we're on page 41. Actually, we're now going to soar into the four planes of liberation. To date, we have covered. We started back. I'll just read the titles of what we've covered. First, what it is as a collection. Secondly, how the Buddha is represented in the Majjhima Nikaya. We covered the Four Noble Truths. We covered the teaching of non-self. And we covered the origin and cessation of suffering. We covered Nibbana. That was easy. The way to the cessation of suffering. We covered the gradual training. Do you remember that? Remember when we talked about the gradual training, we talked about the trainings, meditational trainings, and that at a certain point there were three choices to be made. Remember that? So for some of you that was the most interesting point, wasn't it? And you don't even remember it now? We had quite a discussion about that. Remember that? That's on page 36 if you want a little clue. At the bottom of the page. You can or cannot develop the jhanas, but you do have to develop at least a level of concentration, of one-pointedness of mind, of the mind not wandering, but being able to place it and fix it at one point. That is to say, collect it from the future, collect it from the past, and hold it in the present, right? That makes a powerful mind. You have to be able to do that to enough of a degree so that you attain what is called neighborhood concentration. You can tell you've attained that because it's as if somebody changed the dimmer switch in the room. There's a sense of the light shifting and a deepening of your calm. The mind is stiller. There may still be thoughts, but you're not attached to them in the same way. And that's the level that is absolutely necessary. That's a lot of the training in meditation, is to teach the mind to come out of the past, out of the future, and just stay in the present moment. And you do that by, again and again, just asking to be present, asking to feel in the moment, just asking to feel in the moment. You don't have the power to do any really great work until you can do that with the mind. So that's a lot, isn't it? A lot of the beginning training. And if you realize that and you just get on with it, it doesn't take very long. You know, if you don't argue about whether you're doing it well or not doing it well, or whether you're going to ever do it or not ever going to do it, you don't get into any of that stuff. Because none of that is just the point. The point is just every time you catch your mind, either in the past or in the future, just bring it to the present and see what you can sense in the present moment. Generally speaking, you do it with the sense of touch, right? The sense of touch at the nostril. You try to bring the mind in sync with the body. The body is a tremendous asset because it moves slower than the mind. So you can focus on the feeling of the breath just as it passes there. And you'll get a billion in one. You'll remember where you put that thing you've been looking for 52,000 lifetimes. You know, just before, you know. You'll suddenly recall, you know, all kinds of important things that you should have done immediately, and your life depends on doing them. All these different things will come up. Itches, pain, shakes, sleepiness, blah, blah, blah. And you just keep noting it and keep bringing your mind back. And all of a sudden, at one point, turns. That dimmer switch thing happens, and the mind is focused. And it's a very, it isn't so hard. What's hard is the attachment. Attachment to whether you're doing it well or not. That's what's hard. You know, the sense that you're not doing it well, or you are doing it well, or there's something else you should be doing. You know? All you gotta do is just keep remembering that focus. You just want to bring your mind into the present. Just let go of all your other brilliant ideas. They'll be around. I promise you, if a brilliant idea arises when you're trying to watch your breath, it'll come back. But the present moment is only ever present. It's not replaceable. So that's very important. So it says here in the last paragraph on page 36, from the fourth jhana, and I'm just telling you this, that you don't need to attain the fourth jhana, but up to this point they have been talking in this text, in this introduction, about going through the jhanas. So that's why it's there. Three alternative lines of further development become possible. Do you remember this now? That is to say, the Buddha mentions four meditative states that continue the mental unification established by the jhanas. That is to say, then from a state of concentration, you can go on to explore deeper and deeper states of concentration. The four next ones that the Buddha is talking about are the four called the formless realms. If you go into developing them, you will create a very strong, what they call a garuka kama, which means a very heavy or powerful action that will mark the continuum of your life, the continuum energy of life, and it will create the cause for rebirth in a formless realm, which may or may not be interesting to you. Generally speaking, beings who are reborn in a formless realm, the lifetime after that, end up in hell because they just can't get used to the change. So it may or may not be interesting to you. But those states do exist, and it's very good, I think, for Westerners to actually explore the different realms of concentration, because they actually are different worlds. Your world is dependent on your perception. You change the level of your perception, the whole world is different. That's true, isn't it? So that's what this is talking about. This is the science of perception, the science of the mind. This is what Buddhism, meditation, the Buddhist tradition is on about. Right? So you can go on from that state of concentration, you can go on to explore further depths of concentration and more refined levels of being. That's one thing you can do, right? And there goes a blah, blah, blah about that to the end of that paragraph. A second line of development on page 37, disclosed by the sutras, is the acquisition of supernormal, normal psychic powers. So when the concentration is good enough, it actually helps to have third or fourth jhana, forum level jhana, to develop the psychic powers. Helps have a little more concentration, because when the psychic powers begin to develop, there's this all this excitement about I am doing this, oh I'm moving that by my mind, and then it shakes and it goes. So you need like maybe a bit stronger. You probably do need the fourth jhana to develop the psychic powers. This is the minor psychic powers, they're called, you know, like walking on water and telepathy and telepotency and telerapity, and that's what a rap star does when they awaken. And then the last one, he says here there are the six kinds of direct knowledge, and five of them are psychic powers. That is to say, psychic powers are not based on breaking a law of nature, they are on understanding a more subtle law, right? Like you can talk to me and I can talk to you in this room. If you know how to use a phone and I know how to use a phone, we can talk to each other over a very long distance. If you don't know how to use a phone and I don't know how to use a phone, but you're aware of the energy above your head, and you work with that energy above your head and you call the energy above my head, you can get the same kind of message through to me. You can work on a higher level, right? Pretty well all, it isn't breaking the law of physical, it's just working with a different level of law, right? That's why the psychic powers, you need a more refined mind to be able to use them, because you have to be able to operate with focus on the more refined levels. Okay? The sixth psychic power is actually transcendence, which is the third path that you can take from this level of either the fourth jhanas or concentration. So there are three paths that you can take after you've attained a certain level of concentration in meditation. You can further explore the formless realms, you can further explore psychic powers, or you can further explore liberation from suffering. There are three choices. Contrary to popular belief, there is a time when some people should do psychic powers, when some people should do jhana. And that's more where the Tibetan tradition goes. Yes?
When you say that those are the three different directions?
Three different branches,
yeah,
that the meditation can go in.
Yeah, is there any sense that if you start exploring one, you can't then shift over and explore the other?
No, you can shift over, but don't forget the power of habituation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very... Could I have one of those cushions back there to put my book on, please? And it's very hard to, that's why a teacher is useful.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very hard to see that point where preference based,
mm-hmm,
is what the Tibetans call the gross and subtle conditionings.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, thank you so much, maybe the choice to explore one of them isn't really your choice at all, but subtle conditioning set, mm-hmm, from many lifetimes, mm-hmm, you know? And maybe a teacher would realize you've already got that propensity and you could get stuck there,
mm-hmm,
repeating. For example, when I did a certain amount of practice, it was very clear to me how healing occurred,
mm-hmm,
by balancing the winds. So I went around left, right, and center healing everybody, whether they liked it or not. You know, wrestled them to the floor. You will be healed. And you will love it. Until it suddenly struck me, A, they might have spent lifetimes developing that disease just to that point for some question that was their right. And secondly, this is something that wasn't new to the continuum of this being, and maybe I should explore some new ground. This is a precious birth. So like that, you know? So these are all considerations. It really helps to have a spiritual friend. It really helps a lot. I really am so grateful for my teachers and my spiritual friends, because life is so short. Why, do you realize I'm 60? Oh, you do. That's right.
No.
I just happened. 6-0. I can be crotchety with reason. I'm so glad you didn't know that. Yeah. It's fast. And what would you do without your spiritual friends and your teachers? Who maybe just the slightest little thing can allow you to realize you're flowing along a habitual path because of a subtle conditioned state. And you suddenly say, no, I have the option of opening the consciousness to greater understanding. Not what you do well, but what is there that you would like to expand your understanding into. It's great what I do well, but that isn't my whole work. Sure, you know, I talk very well, but that isn't my whole work. And if it is, it's only a matter of time before I'm useless to you. And it is a precious life. So this is, you know, does that make sense to you? But yes, you can. And there aren't very many, but there are some teachers that one can find in the Theravadin's countries that do teach just jhana. Mm-hmm. And a book by a woman named Aya Kema, who is the self, told you about that book many, many times. She is a wonderful teacher of jhana. And in that book, she's a meditator's meditator. You know? She just lays out the steps. This is what you do. This is what you do. It's a beautiful book. She's been dead for a while now. She's a Westerner. She's a couple of years. She's a Westerner, but very well trained and very clear in the language. You know? You want to explore jhana? And it's, you know, a lot of the time in how this school of Buddhism in particular has come to the West, we sort of, oh, jhana, poo-poo, you know, insight or nothing, you know. That's not necessarily useful for every psyche. I'm going on and on, aren't I? Okay, So that's enough of a review. You're starting to remember what we've covered before? Page 41. The four planes of liberation. Now what I do is I just read it, and if you have any questions or I have any comments, we just interrupt. If you have any questions, just immediately, you know, stick up your hand or just ask it or whatever. If I have anything I want to make a comment on, then I'll do the same. The practice of the Buddhist path evolves in two distinct stages. Mundane, called Lokiya, or preparatory stage, and supramundane, called Lokudra, or consummate stage. Loku means loka or loku means world, and udra means beyond. So lokiya, with the world and beyond the world. right? Relative and absolute would be a good way of talking about it. The mundane path is developed when the disciple undertakes the gradual training in virtue, concentration, and wisdom. You remember we covered that? Sila, Samadhi, and Panya. Remember we covered that?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Should I ask somebody then to tell me what they have? Or should I just keep talking?
Wayne's looking down at his book. Concentration.
Okay, well, I'm sure you're going to review those on your own, aren't you?
Sila's 10 things.
Yeah. The 10 marks of Sila.
Yeah.
Yeah. Samadhi is basically a development of concentration. And Panya is what? Wisdom.
Isn't that the three that's involved in Visuddhimagga too? In the book of Visuddhimagga?
Yeah, Visuddhi.
Visuddhimagga.
Yeah. The Visuddhimagga is laid out in three sections. Mm-hmm. One section is Sila, one section is Samadhi, and one section is Panya. Panya is basically in the Theravadan tradition what?
Wisdom.
No. Yeah? What kind of wisdom? Anicca, dukkha, anatta, nibbana. Remember?
No self.
Yeah.
Impermanence.
Anicca is impermanence. Dukkha?
Suffering.
Yeah, dissatisfactoriness or suffering, right? Anatta? No inherent self. And nibbana, peace. The recognition, the clear seeing of those four things. The clear seeing, that's called wisdom. Right? God, you guys are remembering this real well. This is a very dry class Thursday night. I don't tell many jokes or anything. This reaches its peak in the practice of insight meditation, which deepens direct experience of the three characteristics of existence, which are anicca, dukkha, anatta. When the practitioner's faculties have arrived at an adequate degree of maturity, isn't Buddhism wonderful? You can't say self or, you know, especially after mentioning anicca, dukkha, and anatta, I mean, you certainly can't say it. When you've matured enough. No, no, no. When the practitioner's faculties have arrived at an adequate degree of maturity, the mundane path gives birth to the supramundane path. So called because it leads directly and infallibly out of uttara, out of or beyond the world loka, comprising the three realms of existence to the attainment of the deathless element, nibbana. Do you want me to break that sentence down?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. When the practitioners, I'm not even going to touch the first phrase up to the comma there. The mundane path gives birth to the supramundane path. You know what that means? That means that transcendence or the cessation of suffering is the result of an action. That's what it means. It means it's a result. It's not something you're going to get somewhere else. It means that some action you perform in the here and now will result in transcendence. That means imminence. That means power. That means the power to transcend is present. It's not somewhere else. It's not next week. So called because it leads directly and infallibly out of the world comprising the three realms of existence. Do you know what the three realms of existence is? Are? Was? Do you know what the three realms of existence is? Jeez, you guys, you're all failing, I'm telling you. Form?
Form.
But what's the first one? Desire, form, and formless. Now, you know, ever since I came up here and started sitting on this cushion, maybe even before, when I used to come up here before we had the teaching here, I've been telling you this. The desire realm, how many sense doors do you have? Aha, it's coming through, right? I mean, I don't think more than 3 months go by before I don't repeat this to you. Hmm? Desire realm has how many sense doors?
Six.
Humans are in what realm?
Desire realm.
Right. What are your six sense doors?
Five
senses in the mind. Exactly. The form realm has three sense doors. What are the three sense doors?
Pleasant, unpleasant.
You've branched off into the aggregates and you're talking about types of feeling. Only, and there's five of them, not three. I love the laundry list. Okay, there is. Sight, sound, and mind. Okay, you see all those angels on the Christmas cards? What are they doing? They got this energy radiating out from them. They got these halos and they're singing or playing harps, right? Sight, light, sound, right? And consciousness. All of the form realm. Form means fine material form realm. So when you practice concentration beyond just neighborhood concentration, that is also a heavy karma that allows you to experience beings in the lower God realms, what we would call, you know, the lower ranks of angels. You know that Christianity used to teach about different ranks of angels.
Mm-hmm.
And they still remain to some degree. Yeah. Seraphims? Seraphims and cherubims, right. And then there used to be, in Catholicism, there used to be 11 levels. One of them was the bosom of Abraham, which you know from, that were different realms. And that's very much like Buddhism still teaches that. That there are different realms that you can perceive if you allow your mind to become refined enough in the present. If you pierce through your habitual conceptualization about who I am and what I was doing and what I will be doing, and bring your consciousness strongly into the present, you can perceive many different levels. Is that clear to you? And so the desire realm includes the lower angelic levels. The form realm includes the higher angelic levels, and the formless realm is the formless, the beings who would be called like gods with a small g, right? And so the three realms are the formless realm, where there is one mind, one sense door, mind only. It's formless. The form realm, which has three sense doors, right? Sight, sound, and mind. And the desire realm, which has six sense doors, right? Humans are very fortunate because you're born into the desire realm, but you have the kind of consciousness that has just enough suffering to make you ask a question, and just enough calm to get an answer. So the human consciousness can actually, if it turns itself out to concentration, explore all the realms and expand the understanding of what is not self, which is the reason why you do it. To see how many different ways there are of being, and all of them, the seeds for all of them are within this human realm, but none of them are the self. That's how you use jhana for insight. And it's very powerful because we cling so much to our habituation of who we think we are. Or have you noticed that? So just seeing, you know, just like having a coffee break with a few angels really changes your view of yourself. You know? Few demons, throw them into. And suddenly there isn't quite the same, you know, rigidity about who I am or who I am not. Yeah? No questions? So that's the three realms, right? I wonder if we're going to get more in the paragraph than today. We're just speeding through this, you can tell, okay? Just like... And rollerblade heaven. The three realms of existence to the attainment of the deathless element, nibbana. Now, nibbana is the deathless element. It is not sammasambuddhassa. Shakyamuni Buddha was named what? Sammasambuddhassa. Not arahat. Nibbana, nirvana, in the word we use most often in English, which is the Sanskrit word for it. Nirvana is otherwise known as the attainment of arahatship. That is not what the Buddha was. He was sammasambuddhassa, beyond that. What's beyond arahat? Do you have any idea? What is arahat? Any idea? Like, I mean, if this is going to be your career, do you know the options? Have you checked out the dental plan? This is what you want to do. You want to know what it is. Why are you doing? Why are you sitting there cross-legged and doing all this shit, you know? I mean, I know you don't know why. But you keep doing it. I understand that because that's just, I look in the mirror and that just faces right back out at me. I don't know, but there's something very attractive about it. Right? I'd rather watch the soaps, but they bore me. Right? Is this true?
Yes.
A good high, but been there, done that. So what is nibbana?
Not subject to cycle.
Not subject to the cycle. Exactly. Why? You just about named it right on. There's one definition of nibbana. It is, means, nibbana means gone out. Mm. Gone out of what? Of the fuel for the cycle. Mm. That's the result of nibbana, not being subject to the cycle. Thank you. What nibbana actually means is the going out of what? Greed, hatred, and delusion. Going out of the fuel. Going out of the fuel. So therefore, it is called peace. What nibbana is not, that sammasambuddhassa is total intellectual awakening. Sammasambuddhassa is the ability to see all cause and effect. That is to say, the mind moving beyond continuum. No self to a big degree. Which is where you get the bodhisattva bow, da 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 da, at the whole Mahayana path. The tantric tradition starts it. Is that interesting to you? Mm-hmm. No? Did you understand what I was saying? It is a good point to know. That's why, you know, that's why I go on and on about these arcane things, because it does actually impact on your life. you pay attention. It does actually impact. It changes how you relate in your daily life, knowing these things. Are you interested in developing peacefulness for yourself? Not a bad idea. And there's Daisy to consider. Okay. I don't got Daisy, got Ariel. I mean, there's all that family, really.
Most of them live with me.
And most of them are already live with him. And then there's the people that drop over. If you leave me out, Jack, I'll get you. And look who I bring with me. It impacts. Yes.
Is there something that occurs in reaching a stage of meditation when there's no split between myself or whatever it may be, and the other?
Yes, yes.
And where I'm no longer see the other as a self, the conscience that I mean.
Yes. In one of the really beautiful things that my beloved teacher Namdo Rinpoche taught last time I was at the Dharma Center was he taught that the four yogas trainings that Gampopa set forth. The first one was basically one-pointedness, bringing the mind to one-pointed focus. The second one was no subject object. Third one is inner, outer, the same. And yoga perfection. And so, yes, yes, absolutely. And that is what's being talked about here. You know. Because it can very well be that there is no longer subject-object. That is to say, there is not a belief in an inherent self. But there's still inner, outer. The focus is still just within the continuum in this life. And tomorrow, thank you very much, I've been asked to talk on Guru Yoga. In order to talk on Guru Yoga, I need first to talk about precious human birth, so you understand what Guru is. So tomorrow I'm going to be dealing directly with this question about subject, object, inner, outer, and how Buddhism approaches that. And it is like really very...
On that state of meditation, is that where the sound comes through? I've heard recordings of the throat music in the vocal cords. It almost sounds like a very high-pitched harmonic.
Sound can arise many, many times, James, in meditation practice. It can arise depending on the continuum of the being. I mean, for example, you have a strong interest in music, don't you? So it wouldn't be surprising if the first time you sat down, there would be sounds arise. Well, it doesn't mean you're an ace meditator, or maybe it does. But that's not what the sounds mean. That means that the continuum of your being has a strong affinity toward the sound. And this is like seeds of karma ripening from a long time. You know, from the very no beginning. You know, when I was 2, my family gave me a book. My God, I lit up. You know? didn't want a doll, didn't, I carried that book around. I slept with it. I sat on it when I ate. 2 years old, 2 and a half. Nothing else was really interesting.
A book! A alien book.
You know? So, for, you know, these things arise at different times, depending on a little bit what Jack was discussing about being drawn to certain practices or not drawn to others. And that very much bears into what is the yidam that one is given to work with. It's sort of like, because you've noticed that if you're in a body, you can't be everywhere at once. Have you noticed that? I myself have noticed this on one or two occasions. Try as I might. And that, you know, being in the form world, if you say one word, there's also 20 other words that would cover a part of it that word doesn't. Do you understand? That the form realm never quite just covers exactly. So you're, when you say one word, you're kind of launched on that path already. And then the next word leads from that. And then eventually there becomes a way to take this imperfect vehicle, but make a talent out of it because you know where you're going. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to ever be perfect, but it is something you have an affinity for and a talent for. So over lifetimes, these talents develop, right? They become like the most conducive path for this psyche to craft their quest to find happiness and the cessation of suffering. To work in a spiritual realm. That becomes the best path. That's called yidam. Because of the nature of consciousness coming into form, there are only so many choices of what you can do. You can either be sort of a fiery person or an earthy person, or you can just be a water, or you can be all over the place like a wind blowing, or you can be quite spacious, you know? And then you can be combinations of that. So there are patterns of yidam, so there's only like so many. And then there's wrathful and peaceful. Are you more intellectual than you're wrathful? Are you more into the, just sort of like, you know, going with the flow, then you're more peaceful type, your being state or a knowing state. You think about it, like you separate off and name it, or you, you know, wrathful and peaceful and so forth, right? And then male and female, and da 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 da. So there are these figures called yidams that basically represent the talent or the best way for that psyche to, the continuum of that being the best vehicle for moving it toward transcendence. Usually the talent manifests in the person both as their weakness and their strength. Because generally speaking, what we do well, we also do ill. You've noticed that. I certainly have noticed that with speech. And words, right? And the discrimination, mind of discrimination, how often it has been used in negative ways. Or rather than opening to silence. Feeling uncomfortable and jumping in with speech, right? But it is a talent that whoever made me had done a lot of work with. I mean, there's no question about that, is there? I mean, not always be leading you into great paths, but at least there is some quality of speech that this being has inherited that brings some joy to your life, doesn't it? It's not me, this is part of the continuum being. Music can arise. Doesn't mean you should necessarily do it. Sometimes the yidam is a hidden talent. Does that answer you in a satisfactory way? Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Moving right along. So the Nibbana means peacefulness. It means the going out of greed, hatred, and delusion. Right? It does not mean Samasambuddhasa. It does not mean omnipotence, omnipresence, all-knowing. It is not liberation of the mind, of you, except in clearly seeing the three signs, but not in a universal way. Sama sambuddhasa, universal way. Okay. Progress along the supermundane path is marked by four major breakthroughs, each of which ushers the disciple through two subordinate phases called the path, magga, and the fruit, phala. The phase of path has the special function of eliminating a determinate number of defilements. There are altogether 10 defilements, which you and I are subject to. And as each path is attained, a certain number of defilements are either eliminated totally. For example, first time you experience the path, 3 defilements are immediately eliminated. Second time you experience the path, then a further 2 are weakened. Means a big thing when they're weakened. Right? And so forth. The mental impediments that hold us in bondage to the round of rebirths, that's right, that cause you to not be able to see, that cause you to be caught by views, your views, by emotions, the emotions that continuously race around and bite you. Right? When the work of the path has been completed, the disciple realizes its corresponding fruit. So you have the experience of the breaking of the fetters or the defilements or whatever you want to call them. My friend Kamananda used to call them fretters. There's these 10 fretters, he'd say. So whenever I talk about them, I tend to think of them as fretters, because I just thought that was very good. There are these 10 fretters. So first time you experience the path, the first 3 of the 10 fretters are broken. And then the fruit of that is you come back into name and form and experience again, the mundane world, but with this difference, and that's called the fruit. That the consciousness is irrevocably changed. That's called stream entry. Okay? The canonical formula of homage to the Sangha refers obliquely to these four planes of liberation, each with its phase of path and fruit, when it extols the Blessed One's community of noble disciples as comprised in the 4 pairs of persons, the 8 types of individuals. I see it. 4 pairs of persons are those stream entry, once returner, no time returner, and arahat. And the 8 characteristics, 8, what do they call it here?
8 types of individuals.
8 types of individuals are the path and the fruit of each of those 4. These 4 pairs are obtained by taking for each stage the one who has entered upon the way to realization of the fruit and the one who has attained the fruit. In the sutras, the Buddha highlights this. Isn't Buddhism wonderful, the language they use? Imagine reading this to yourself late one night. What? In the sutras, the Buddha highlights the specific characteristics of each supramundane stage in 2 ways, by mentioning the defilements that are abandoned on each plane and the consequences its attainment bears on the process of rebirth. He handles the elimination of the defilements by classifying these into a tenfold group called the 10 fretters, samyojana. You know, in the early days with my beloved teacher, Ananda Bodhi, we had to memorize all this stuff when I was your age. We had to be able to quote the Samyojanas if we wanted to do a retreat with him. He got it so easy. Because we all wanted to do a retreat. Hey. The disciple enters upon the first supramundane path either as a Dharma follower or as a faith follower. This is interesting. The former is one in whom wisdom is the dominant faculty. The latter one who progresses by the impetus of faith. You could say by view or by emotion. By the head or by the heart. You could say. Which is the same way that yidams are. Wrathful or peaceful yidams are. Assigned deities. Wrathful, peaceful. This path, the path of stream entry, has the task of eradicating the grossest three fetters. Personality view, that is the view, the belief in an inherent self. That there is a fixed or inherent or independent, separate self, independent of any condition. And then it's just broken. It's just like suddenly it's clearly not true. The view of a self, that is to say, the view of a self among the five aggregates. Okay. Remember the five aggregates? Form. It's your turn, Blaine. Feeling. Say feeling. You said three of them before.
Form, feeling.
Perception. Mental formations and consciousness. Five aggregates. And second one, doubt in the Buddha and his teaching. I learned that one not as doubt in the Buddha and his teaching, but I learned that as the breaking of the fetter that causes belief in rule and ritual. That is to say, no longer superstitious. So no longer caught in superstition, no longer believing in ritual or rule as efficacious, but understanding how things come into being passively.
Being more or less, everything's cause and effect. Or I'm not sure if I understand that the aspect of superstition and ritual. That concept, you would not believe in...
Rule and ritual, that they are going to save you. You wouldn't understand cause and effect rather than rule and ritual.
Okay.
You wouldn't think if I cross my fingers and close my eyes, the light won't turn red before I get to the intersection.
Okay.
You'd think if I cross my fingers and close my eyes, how will I see where I'm driving? You know? Right? And adherence, that was the third one, right? Adherence to external rule and observances, either ritualistic or aesthetic. Okay, doubt in the, that's right, skeptical doubt is what we translated doubt in the Buddha and his teaching. Skeptical doubt. That is to say, not being able to be open to a valid teaching, but we never learned it as the Buddha and his teaching. We learned it as a valid. Not being able to hear. There are people who cannot hear. When you say to them, you know, you're about to step over a cliff, they say, I wonder why you're telling me that, as they keep walking forward. Because their sense of themselves not stepping over a cliff is so strong, they can't hear anyone else. We do that a lot, don't we? In larger, small ways. So that's what this is saying, that the person is no longer unable to hear a valid teaching. You clearly know skeptical doubt is broken. That's how I learned that. Skeptical doubt, not doubting the Buddha and his teaching. So, first of all, the belief in an inherent self is gone, skeptical doubt is gone, and belief in rule and ritual is gone, with one experience of transcendence of the path. So that's not a bad career choice, don't you know? How you do it? Just hot in here?
No.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Why don't you open this one a little bit, Blaine? Can we do that, Bob?
Mm-hmm.
It's warm out tonight. If you get too cold, we'll close it. We just got another 5 minutes or so to go. Is that good? Don't, the cats will come in. They're not allowed. They haven't done their homework. You doing okay? You all right? Is this interesting to you? Okay. This is our dry class, so that's why, you know. Where am I? The three, right? When the disciple realizes the fruit of this path, of this first experience of transcendence, when he realizes this, he becomes a stream entry. So there is an experience where those three fetters are extinguished. As soon as that experience occurs, that ends those three things. They can no longer exist because this experience is just like totally shows that the falseness of them. And then there is a realization of that. There are two distinct different steps.
Isn't that also necessarily like, I mean, it's like a rope and there's like little strings of that get broken. Because I feel that that transcendence, that consciousness that changes forever, that there are moments, little moments of those that happen like all the time.
There are, but one where there is no, you know, there are little moments of it, but when where those three are totally extinguished, there's only one. And so that's why they use the analogy of somebody who is walking along and then they come, a river is in their way and there's a rope hanging. And you go to the river bank and you take the rope and you practice running back, and then just before you're going to swing you say, no, wait a minute, I'm going to go pick some raspberries off that bush. So you go back and forth and you can see the other side. So every time you see the other side, there's a little more faith. That is, a little bit of those little things do get broken. There is an insight. But when you actually grab that rope and swing across and let go, sometimes you even swing and don't let go, you know. But when you actually let go and you always land on the other shore, when you actually do let go, you always land on the other shore, then you are on the other shore. It's like, that's the analogy that is used in the scriptures. It's a rope and...
Mm-hmm.
So even though it's... The Buddha gave that analogy, even though it's called stream enterer, he means you get on the other shore, not that you fall in the stream. You've entered the stream that goes to the ocean of consciousness. Huh? Pardon?
When you're used to the playing film, you should wish the same thing. You know, a third-story window, a large tree tower on the rope, monkey would throw the rope back. You have to jump out, you didn't have the rope. But you leap, you have to leap to the rope. Then grab it and keep going.
Yeah.
That
and it feels like that. Only if you actually do let go, you always land safely. It feels like that. And what stops you from letting go is the fear or the expectation, the clinging to an I. And it's only the experience of letting go of the rope where the clinging to the eye is broken. Okay, can we go on here? Now, when the disciple realizes fruit of this path, he becomes a stream enterer who has entered the stream of the Noble Eightfold Path that will carry him irreversibly to peace, to the going out of the defilements, to Nibbana. Nibbana means the going out. The stream enterer is bound to reach final liberation in a maximum of 7 more births. This is a Theravadan tradition. He's bound to meet final being subject to rebirth, is truth. From my perspective is of a Vajrayana practitioner. So I would say he is within 7 births. He will not be subject to rebirth. And he cannot create any cause that would... He has totally destroyed any option of being born in a lower form. And the process cannot be reversed. He will attain no longer being subject to rebirth. Choices can be made, but not blindly subject. Not coming home one day and everybody saying, oh, we've decided you don't live here anymore, you gotta go live over there now. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine going home and having everybody in your house totally different and they say, oh no, you live over there, you're now a street person. Oh no, now you have to go live in that house over there on the river valley. And you got somebody who doesn't know how to do windows who comes in once a week. And that's your suffer. And so forth, right? The second supramundane path attenuates to a still greater degree the root defilements of lust, hatred, and delusion. though without yet eradicating them. On realizing the fruit of this path, the disciple becomes a once-returner, Sakadagamin, who is due to return to this world, the sense sphere realm. Remember that? The 3 realms of existence? The sense sphere means desire realm, 6 senses. Only one more time and then make an end of suffering. It is possible that someone can only have to appear in a womb. And sometimes, you know, someone miscarries when they've almost come to term. It could be that that being that was in their womb, that's the only birth they were, the only appearance they needed to make in the form realm. The third path eradicates the next 2 fetters. So, see, the second experience of the path, Sakadagamin, weakens the fourth and fifth fetter. The third experience of the path totally eradicates them. And those 2 are desire for sensual desire and anger in their crudest forms. It issues in the fruit of the non-returner. Yes, this is the last time such a being will be subject to rebirth, who is due to reappear by spontaneous birth in one of the special celestial realms called the Pure Abodes, and there attain final Nibbana without ever returning from that world. The fourth and last supramundane path is the path of Arahantship. This path eradicates the 5 higher fetters, which are a desire for a rebirth in a fine material form, and in the desire for rebirth in the immaterial form. So these 2 are still desire, but they're a much more refined desire. Right? So because desire, sensual desire for sense pleasure, was eradicated, and desire for ill was eradicated with the last, and so this with the third experience of the past. So this now the most subtle desires are eradicated. Conceit. So you say, okay, if a sense of self disappears at the first experience of the path, how come there is conceit? Is anyone saying that, or is that only the question that came to my mind when I first learned this? Because although there is no sense of self, there is still the memory of the cause and effect of what the experiences of this life has been, and attachment to the habits of this life, the survival patterns of this life. So I have studied with many great and wonderful teachers, and almost every one of them have told me that theirs is the only path. Because in their experience, that was exactly true. Every one of them was telling the truth. And every one of them was a worthy teacher. Joanne says hello, by the way. I was speaking to Joanne, and she was saying, I'm really frustrated because I feel uncomfortable, but all of my teachers here tell me that this is the only way. I said, they're probably very good teachers. They're telling you what they know has worked for them. So it's conceit in the path, not conceit in a sense of self. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
You know that somebody's honest if they're telling you what they know. So for them, it was the only way. Asama Sambuddhasa would not be caught in that. Nor an arahat. But arahats are few and far between, and you can imagine how much fewer and far further between are Asama Sambuddhasas. Restlessness. Now, well, obviously this room, we're free of that, so I guess the arahats aren't so far between as I previously thought. And ignorance, that is to say, subtle ignoring. This is like, you know, every one of these 10 fetters, especially my beloved teacher Ananda Bodhi gave wonderful teaching on these. He really made us study these. And I'm really tempted, you know, to just go blah, blah, blah about it. Instead, I hope you will do a little research. I hope you'll look them up in a Buddhist dictionary. I hope you try to understand what they mean to you in your life. I hope you start being interested in what the different stages of the path mean, and what the career choices are, and what is the dental plan. You know, it's worth checking it out. You've been at this for a while, eh, somebody? Might be nice to know whether you get a company car or not, you know? What kind of vehicle am I going to take? A fully liberated one. By realization of the fruit of this path, the practitioner becomes an arahant, a fully liberated one, who here and now enters upon and abides in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. That is to say, greed, hatred, and delusion are totally, they're the taints in the Theravada, are totally obliterated, and so that there is no view tainted by them. Still could be, from a Samasambuddhasa point of view, a narrowness of understanding. The mind has not gone to totality. It's still working within cause and effect that is within the continuum experience. The arahant will be discussed further in the next section. The commentaries often referred to in the notes of this translation develop an interpretation of the paths and fruits based upon the systematization of the Buddhist teaching known as the Abhidhamma, which is one of the three pitikas, remember? Drawing upon the Abhidhamma's depiction of the mind as a sequence of discrete, momentary acts of consciousness called chittas, The commentaries understand each supramundane path to be a single occasion of consciousness arising at the climax of a series of insights into the Dharma or into the law. Each of the four momentary path minds or cittas eliminates its own fixed set of defilements to be followed immediately by its fruition, which consists of a string of momentary cittas that enjoy the bliss of nibbana made accessible by the breakthrough of the path. Now that probably means nothing to 98% of you, and I am not even going to start to explain it. If you want to ask a question, maybe I will, but we only got 5 minutes left and I'm intent on finishing this section in the next 5 minutes. Though this conception of the paths and fruits is regularly employed by the commentators as an hermeneutical tool for interpreting the sutras, it is not explicitly formulated as such in the old Nikayas. Understand that the Abhidhamma Pitaka was actually not in its stage, in the state that we have it today, was actually not written in the time of the Buddha, but some 300 or 400 years after. So there was an Abhidhamma, but it was not the present one. The present one was developed after time after the Buddha.
Based on his memory of the monks?
I don't think anybody was living at that time who had known the Buddha.
No, it would be passed down, though.
I'm not sure. Okay. See, there's a lot of question about that, and yeah, we can. Here, let me just finish this bit, and then we can get into some very interesting discussion about the purity of the Buddhist teaching. Mm-hmm. Though this conception of the paths and fruits is regularly employed by the commentators. Oh, I already did that, didn't I? I realized it when I got to hermeneutical.
And what does that mean?
What does it mean?
It has to do with the same, you know, it comes from the Western mysteries, Hermes, the magical. It's like a vessel within which one can cook up. It's an alchemical term, actually. And it's used today mainly by academics who believe that bullshit baffles brains. Although not always. It is like a concept that can allow one to take and examine mind states by naming them as these. It's very much like some of the physics. When I had the great good fortune of going to a weekend, a very extended weekend of teaching with David Bohm, a wonderful physicist who wrote the textbook that was used for a long time for quantum physics in all the universities. He was one of the people that helped develop atomic power in the Mexican desert during World War II, and then later was extremely unhappy about the way it was used and so forth. And an amazing man. He said that the problem with physics is that it depends so much on mathematics as its language, and a lot of the people in physics don't understand that what they are studying is only works within mathematics, right? Does that make sense to you? And that you have to move it beyond that language in order to really be useful in the world. And you could say that mathematics is an hermeneutical tool for physics, because it gives a framework within which you can Schrodinger's cat, and you can examine ideas and maybe come to great insights through them, but then outside of that language, whether or not it works. This is probably the most clear definition of the Abhidhamma I have ever read, because that's exactly what the problem with the Abhidhamma is. It really is like physics. Within that language, it's brilliant. Right? Is that good? It is not explicitly formulated as such in the old Nikayas, old collections. Remember? Nikaya. This is the Majjhima Nikaya. And it is not explicitly formulated. That is to say, you cannot find that the Buddha actually said anything that's written in the present day Abhidhamma when you read the Nikayas. That's interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes. And at times there even appears to be a a tension between the two. Oh! Dissension in the Buddhist ranks. Oh! A faint, a swoon. My faith is shook. That's what I really love about Buddhism. You know, they changed, at the third council, they decided that they would change how they referred to the Buddha. They would make him omnipotent and omnipresent and all that right from day one, right from the time he was born, because he didn't really measure up to some of the Brahmical gods, and they were having some problem with converts. So they did that. They changed some of the sutras. But then they wrote that in the sutras to say they were doing that. This is what I truly love about Buddhism. I just think that's so sweet, you know. Thank you for giving me that information. In case I hadn't noticed that words are not perfect. That being in a form always leaves all the things that aren't within that form out, you know. In case I hadn't noticed that, you're telling me that this happens even in a religion. I'm saying, oh, thank you very much, that's true. It's beautiful, isn't it? There even appears, I think we should underline that, there even appears to be a tension between the two. For example, in the passage of Majjhima Nikaya 142.5, describing the four persons on the path as distinct recipients of offerings. Thank you. Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? We made it through another section. I'm just terribly pleased. I didn't get bogged down halfway. The temptation was great. Oh God, I hope. I don't know. You know, actually, do you want me to tell you what I was thinking of doing? Is I think, I mean, we're almost done the introduction, you know. We really are. We've almost done the introduction. And I thought that when we would finish the introduction that what we would do is I would give you a sign, you, to read and study each sutra, and then come back and we'd have a discussion on what you read.
Sure.
So I would like to go through the introduction with you so that we all, I'm not saying that I'm going to give you the right explanation, but we all have the same idea of what the different terms mean. Right?
Yeah.
And that's why I keep reviewing it with you and asking you, you know, what are the three realms of existence? What are, you know, you noticed I do that? I think you have noticed that. Thank you. What a concept. Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Just in terms of learning the difference. The lists, I guess, in terms of what's here. Book Mainstream Buddhism, the one.
It's pretty good, isn't it?
At the back, he does a lot of stuff.
I mean, there's a lot to be said for that book. I found that book very useful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's actually, they have it in chapters. And I think they still do. And it's very much written from a Theravadan perspective. And he is very, you know, he is very well researched. He is like one, he's trained in England. So he isn't, so much, Eastern Theravadan. So he has his biases and slants. And I don't always agree with him. And I found him very helpful, very useful, very clear for and it's really interesting to read Theravadan, the real Theravadan tradition, just really explore it and see what the roots of the Buddhist teaching really are. which is why we're doing this Thursday class, right? Remember when we started these classes, I told you we're going to study Buddhism, and by the end of it, most of you might decide you don't want to be Buddhist. Because it's not very attractive, you know. Give up my greeds. I'm going to let go of all my desires except that one. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Very quiet. Did any of you actually look at any of this during the last 2 months? Oh, I'm glad. I'm very glad to hear that. It is interesting, isn't it?
When you went through this, I mean, given your background, you're able to say, well, you know, I disagree with this, and I agree with this, and I disagree with this. Well, I guess maybe that's where the teacher comes in, that, because I mean, when I'm reading through this, I can't say that. I mean, I can all take this, and it's all true, because he's...
Yeah, it's called a commentary.
Yeah.
It's a part of teaching is to give a commentary. And if one is very fortunate, one hears commentary on the same text from 4 or 5 teachers. If one is very fortunate. Because of the limitations of form. Because Sama Sambuddhasas are so rare in the universe. No disrespect to any teacher. If you really understand the teaching, you understand how respectful it is. You know what bravery it takes for someone to stand up and give a commentary? Something like this. Other than a big mouth like me. Do you know what kind of bravery it takes? It's a powerful. A powerful action. And it has consequences. Many, many. I remember my beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche saying one time, you know, in his how kind and gentle he always is. He was watching us all leaving a class, and then at the next class he told us what a bunch of crows we were, you know, cawing and flapping and fighting over bits and pieces of the teaching and tearing it apart when we left. It's very brave to teach, to give a commentary. He's very brave to say things like that to a bunch of crows. I mean, he was right on. He was very brave to just make that very clear. It's true, isn't it? The kind of bravery that someone has to like name, you know, the kind of self-assurance, self-affirming that people get after they leave a class by quoting you or, you know, being willing to put up with that and keep trying to make commentaries. That's very brave. And I think it's very useful to hear a lot of different teachers give commentary on the same work. Because maybe it will wake up that part of you that cannot just look, read to get the right answer, but reads and hears the right answer inside and in your own commentary. That's the point. That's the only reason for the bravery. Not because I'm telling you the right way, because God knows. That's not the point. The point is, here is something. Does it ring truth in you? Reach deeper. Are you listening deep enough? Do you hear your own commentary coming forward? Is the guru arising in this room? Because it's our responsibility for that to happen. Does that help?
Yes. Which?
Just what you don't like to hear. No right answers. Humph. Humph.
Just more questions.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Hackman.
I can't help but remember a very vivid situation when Mandevoy was teaching. It could happen to all of us. We all had the room in the room. Something could happen to him and to the pupils. But, there was a young man who came in early to all the lectures. He sat in a pool of us, not just a half of us. A pool of us right in front of the teacher. He's only there half an hour early.